Hello and welcome to another edition of Miles to Go. Miles O'Brien here, Northridge, California, northern part of the San Fernando Valley, home to Valley Girls. And here's a detail you probably did not know, the world's most overeducated garbage man. And that is a title that he does not reject. As a matter of fact, I think he kind of embraces it. His name is Dr. Eugene Sung. He's with UCLA and some other organizations. He's a professor of law, a professor of engineering, and really the only professor who teaches solid waste management that we know of. Is that accurate to say, Eugene?
Well, there's other professors that teach solid waste, but probably we at UCLA, we have the most comprehensive two-year program on solid waste management.
You know, garbage is something that we, most of us, don't think a lot about. Before we get into your story and how you got into garbage, as it were, give us a sense of how much science and technology is a part of managing our waste stream.
Actually, the management of trash requires a lot of scientific knowledge in many, many different fields. And managing trash is one of the hardest things to do, primarily because it is such a heterogeneous material. It's different from city to city, day to day, season to season. For example, after Halloween, your trash stream may be 50% pumpkins for that 1 week. And after Thanksgiving, it's all turkey bones.
So that can change a lot of things, I suppose, in how you manage it. Is that do landfills have to anticipate the pumpkin rush?
Well, landfills have to anticipate not only the changes in composition, but they also have to anticipate changes in volumes, according to the season, whether school's in or school's out, or whether your city has a theme park or no theme park, and many different aspects of trash management.
What drew us to you is a story we're doing for the PBS NewsHour on methane, which is a particularly potent greenhouse gas, not as long-lived as CO2, but something that is of concern if you're concerned about climate change. Turns out, at the top of the list of methane emitters are dairy farms, cattle production, and number two on the list are landfills in this country. Why is that, Eugene?
Well, methane is generated within a landfill. What happens is, the trash that we throw away, at least in the United States, contains a lot of organics, like food and yard waste and paper and materials that rapidly decompose. And as these materials decompose in the landfill, it generates greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide and methane.
So you say there are more advanced countries than the United States when it comes to this. I've spent a little bit of time in Japan where you have to divide your trash at least six ways, maybe seven. And people do it, and they do it with great rigor, let's say. And there's a cultural component to that. But at the root of that is not just being frugal with resources, but it does make it easier to manage the methane problem. Explain how that works.
Well, what happens in Japan, and actually in some of the more advanced European countries like Germany, is there's a lot of what we call source separation. So residents not only embrace what they call a recycling-based society, but they actively participate in segregation of trash into useful components, materials that can be reused or recycled. And so things like paper is not going to the landfill, and they would separate food, and the food would go to either composting facilities or what we call digestion facilities. And the food would be not put in landfills, so those materials would not end up generating the greenhouse gases.
So if they're separated out, you can process them differently in such a way that the energy is recovered in some fashion, whether it's gaseous and to run a power plant or in chemical fashion. Explain how that works.
Well, methane is a base material that can be made into many other chemicals. So you can actually take, for instance, trash, you can actually make ethanol. You can make other types of chemicals like methanol. So there's a lot of things you can do through chemical processes. One of the things in the United States is we look at recycling as recycling paper to paper or glass to glass. That's straight recycling. There are things, what we call upcycling, which means we can take things like glass and make things that are more value added, like fiberglass or construction materials that have a higher value use. So other countries are way more advanced than the U.S. in terms of utilizing trash as a resource.
Why aren't we smarter about this here?
We have the knowledge, but I think it's the lack of political will. And also, I think as a society, we're not willing to pay the cost. The Japanese and in certain countries in the European Union, they pay a much higher cost for these types of programs and for this infrastructure. We're just very, very cheap in this country when it comes to managing trash. I can give you an example. The average cost of taking things to a landfill, the tipping fee at a landfill is about $50 per ton for every ton of trash that's deposited there, on average. In Japan and some of these other places, the tipping fee can be upwards of $300 to $400 a ton. And that's a cost that they're willing to pay for a better environment and for better public health. That's, in the U.S., that's just not an acceptable cost. And that's, a lot of that's due to the lack of political leadership in this field.
We have a society that's a throwaway society. We also have a society that is deeply ingrained in the idea that when you run out of space or land or resources, you just move on to the next space. But that doctrine is no longer real anymore. We've run out of space, and it seems as if our thinking has not caught up with that. Would you agree?
Correct. Well, we actually have an abundance of land here in the United States, and we don't quite have the regulatory drivers that they have in the European Union and in Japan. They have mandates to phase out landfills, to reduce and to actually eliminate the disposal of decomposable materials to landfills. We don't have that in this country. We only recently in California have passed legislation starting the reduction of organics being disposed in the landfills.
Take us under the hood a little bit. What's happening in a landfill that makes all the methane?
As organic materials are disposed, the oxygen that's trapped within the trash is actually consumed. Once the oxygen is gone, in the absence of oxygen, we call that anaerobic digestion. That actually starts occurring. So the materials that are organic, like food waste and yard waste and paper, they start decomposing. And during the decomposition process, because it's in a situation where there's no oxygen, the byproducts of decomposition is water, methane, and carbon dioxide. And so the methane and carbon dioxide are what we call landfill gas, along with a little bit of trace gases of other chemical compounds. But those methane and carbon dioxide are the primary constituents of landfill gas that's emitted from the landfill.
I don't think, you know, a lot of people, when they think about climate change, they say, hey, I traded in my SUV, I got a Tesla or a Prius, I'm doing my part. They probably don't think much about the trash bag that they put out on the street once a week, which may have a greater impact in some ways.
Correct. That's one of the things that people don't think about. They don't link the recycling and the management of trash or how much trash you generate to the what we call the climate change or the greenhouse gas impact of the waste management impact of the trash disposal.
Let's back up just a little bit. How did a guy like you end up becoming the most overeducated garbage man?
Well, it was almost a default. In the early 70s, I got a job in an engineering research lab at UCLA, and the only project that was available to me and which nobody wanted was this project that basically was a grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that said, nothing goes to landfill. There's the trash can, and invent stuff so that all trash can be useful and nothing goes to landfill. So that was my project. I basically just got in the trash can, and as my wife says, I never got out. I just fell in love with the trash field.
Back up just a little bit, though. You came to the United States, your family with roots in China and Japan, and you were in Los Angeles, not a U.S. citizen yet, right? And you wanted to work in aerospace. Talk a little bit about that, because that's an interesting point.
Well, back in the 60s and early 70s, most of the engineering research work was military, or you had to be a U.S. citizen to work on it. And I was not a citizen at that time, so I ended up with a project that basically nobody wanted. And it was my fortune to actually fall in love with that and find that field so fascinating that I actually never got out. there's actually another aspect which kind of goes back to very Asian family roots. Is when we first came here when I was 9 years old, my dad actually sat me down and said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I want to be an artist." And he basically said, "You stink as an artist and you're going to be an engineer." And he goes, "Well, if you don't want to be an engineer, you can leave home." So that was the only choice I had. And throughout junior high school and high school, this is how tough Asian dads are. Only 1 hour TV a week on the weekend. And the only thing I can remember throughout my entire school life, from elementary school, junior high school, is the one thing that he said to me: if you don't get straight A's, you know what's going to happen to you? You're going to end up a garbage man.
You know, when I was a young guy, I wanted to be a garbage man in the worst way. I did. And the reason was I thought it'd be really cool to hang on the back of the truck and ride along. Did you ever think that?
No, that was scared the hell out of me. I just found so many interesting things in the trash. And I have a garage full of trash from, well, my wife says it's trash, but it's actually, I call them teaching examples from all over the world that people have sent me. And I think my wife's just waiting for me to retire so she can burn the garage down.
Well, you know, they say one man's trash is another man's teaching example, I guess, right?
Yes.
You really do have a garage full of trash.
Yes.
And most guys who put a bunch of junk in their garage are forced to clean it up sooner or later. You're holding firm because it's got an academic and altruistic goal.
Yes, I have trash samples from different landfills around the world, and which I actually use in my engineering class.
So I'm just imagining you coming through immigration and customs from your various trips, and you've got a duffel bag full of... Describe what's in the duffel bag.
Well, I can give you my worst example. I have a number of patents on glass processing. And so I had in a plastic bag this very fine white powder, which is powdered glass.
I see where this is headed, by the way.
And so you can imagine what happens at customs when they pull out this nice big baggie that's sealed and it's got white powder in it. And
they assume the position is what they say at that point, right?
Well, they just looked at me and said, "Well," and I said, "Well, take a look at what's around it. It's all trash samples. That's ground glass. If you don't believe me, go ahead and take a taste." He just looked at me and says, "Get out of here."
Of course, I'm thinking about it now. If you were smuggling contraband and you wanted to get past those dogs with those good noses, you would want to enshroud it in garbage, I think, right?
I don't think that would work.
All right, so you travel the world. You consult with other countries. You really take waste management into the realm of science. And this is not a field that is crowded, is it? Why do you suppose others have not gone to the trash can and never come back like you?
Well, I think if you look at the word trash and garbage and disposal, it has such negative connotations. If you look at trash, it's white trash, you're trashed, meaning you're drunk, or garbage in, garbage out, right? So it has this negative connotation. And I think that goes a long way with the perception that this isn't a field with a lot of science and already only the uneducated gets into it. And that's one thing that I've been trying to change in the universities. It's actually very hard to even get a university to take this as a serious engineering topic when this is the thing that it actually needs the most.
Why do you say it needs it the most?
Because as you've seen on the tour of the landfill, it is such a complex living, breathing, it changes every single moment type of operation that you got to deal with. You can't just be good in one aspect of engineering. So like trying to figure out what to do with trash, you have to understand the social, cultural implications of how you set up programs, what makes people participate. You have to learn how to do environmental communications. You have to learn about what motivates people to recycle and why they don't recycle. It's the convenience factor. For example, if you have a trash can next to a recycling bin, they're more than 4 feet or 5 feet apart, people will not take the effort in this country to walk that extra few feet to separate it. So a good program, those bins gotta be next to each other. Like I said, in Japan, you have separations 6-7 times. Some cities, 10 to 12, the most I've ever seen was 21 separations. We can't even do 3 separations in this country correctly.
I have a good friend who's an expat who lives in Tokyo. When he was new to Japan, he didn't put his trash in the right bag at the right time in the right place. And one day he opened up the door to his apartment, and there was all of his trash with a note saying, redo it. Does that surprise you?
Absolutely not. This is the experience of many, many students that have gone to Japan to live there. It's the social pressure and the people that watch over the recycling at the local level, at the individual homes, is so significant that you learn to recycle correctly and quickly, very fast.
It's interesting because in Japan, you don't see a lot of just trash cans in the street. Basically, the convenience stores have them. But it's kind of hard to find a trash can, isn't it?
There's a couple issues related. A lot of that sociocultural, and you probably notice you don't see people walking and eating. That's just not accepted. And if you do that, you carry your own trash. And if you look at in the public places like the train stations, you'll notice there's really no trash cans. And if there are, they're all only clear bags. That actually goes back to security issues. I don't know if you remember this, but there was a sarin attack. Mm-hmm. That was actually through the trash.
So that actually has a security component as well. Mm-hmm. How is it when you talk about the methane production of landfills? Is that one of the big concerns that people in your realm think about, the methane that comes out of landfills, or are there bigger fish to fry, as it were?
No, methane emissions from landfills is one of the biggest regulatory concerns for two issues. One is you have to control the emissions from the landfill as it goes into the atmosphere, but you also have to worry about the migration underground of the methane from the landfill into surrounding properties, because methane is basically an explosive gas in certain concentrations. So if you have homes nearby landfills, you have the potential of methane seeping into the homes and actually cause explosions in residential or commercial establishments.
Has this happened?
Yes. And you'll see this as the city's grown. You'll see there's a lot of development built around landfills. And these developments basically have to have methane monitors and alarms built as part of the building so that there's actually warnings that are given when methane is detected.
You told us some other stories about the hazards of methane as it relates to landfills. Give us some anecdotes.
There's actually cases where people have been playing golf on golf courses built over landfills, where these are very old landfills in the older days, and where the landfill gas collection system was not adequate or non-existent, where they would light up a cigarette and they would actually instantly lose their eyebrows and hair because they would be on fire from the methane.
Wow.
Yes, not a pretty sight.
I bet not. How did they do it? Fare okay aside from the loss of the eyebrows?
Yeah, it actually goes out pretty quick, but it's not a good experience to have by any means.
So the methane is produced in this anaerobic process for quite some time, long after the landfill is recovered and turned into a golf course or whatever. Is that what happens?
Yes. Landfills have a certain life. So after you stop putting trash in it, a landfill has to be closed, goes through these regulatory procedures. But even after it's closed, the materials continue to decompose and you can get methane generation. Not at very high concentrations, but it goes on for more than 100 years.
100 years, so that's really something to consider. Is that something, when you do make the golf course, are engineers thinking about that these days so you don't have that poor golfer losing his eyebrows down the road?
Yes, even as landfills are operating, we have landfill gas collection systems that are installed as the landfill is being constructed. And as landfills close, it's a regulatory requirement that these be monitored and maintained for, you know, pretty much into perpetuity.
So Sunshine Canyon, which we walked through a little while ago, is much more engineered than I would have guessed. Not knowing a lot about landfills, I thought it was, for all intents and purposes, just, you know, piling up trash on top of trash and eventually covering it over with some soil and a little bit of that spray-on grass and walk away. It's much more complex than that, isn't it? Give us an idea of some of the things that you have to do to keep a landfill safe and contained?
Well, it actually starts way before even the landfill starts construction. It goes through a very comprehensive design review, what's proposed, and has to meet all the regulatory requirements. In addition to that, the stricter requirements can actually be imposed by local agencies to adjust for certain local conditions. So that's just the design. the day-to-day operations and just the care that you take in the details. And I think you saw today of all the aspects going on, and in terms of installing the landfill gas collection systems, and putting in and operating the leachate collection system. Leachate is basically the water or the liquids that are generated from the decomposition from the trash or the rainwater that passes through trash, that we call that leachate. That has to be managed. And then the trash has to be covered up every day, so that's what we call daily cover. And then if you're not going to go back to any area of the landfill over a certain time, we actually require a much more rigorous or stricter covering. Temporarily, we call that intermediate cover. Literally thousands of conditions that are required of a landfill. So landfills have whole groups of what we call environmental compliance people that make sure that all the regulations are followed. And not just the regulations, but also the what we call the local land use conditions. And in addition to that, landfills are a major part of the local infrastructure in terms of the businesses that they serve. So I think most landfills actually play a huge part in terms of working within the local business infrastructure too.
Most landfills are not desired by neighbors, and Sunshine Canyon certainly is one of those. Having said that, we love to just throw things in the trash and not think about it. Is it unrealistic for us to say, hey, not in my backyard? So we got to put our trash somewhere, right?
Yes. Well, we have a saying that I think everybody understands. It's NIMBY, it's not in my backyard. But a lot of people in the environmental business actually say it's not just NIMBY, it's NIMTOO. And NIMTOO is N-I-M-T-O-O. It's not in my term of office. Political people, especially up for re-election, really don't like to be tied to a controversial environmental project. So that's one of the sayings we have also. It's an issue of lack of political leadership.
NIMTOO. NIMTOO, I'm going to start using that. That applies in so many things right now in our political leadership, and it has bearing on so many problems that we're grappling with, or more accurately, not grappling with so well. One of the things, frankly, you gave us a nice tour, but we were told we couldn't take our cameras out. They're nervous about that. Mm-hmm. This, to my eye, a layperson's eye, and through your eyes as an expert, seems to be a pretty well-run landfill. I think you probably said the most regulated landfill, perhaps the most...
Highest standards. It's actually the landfill liner system. The original design is actually the technical requirements meets the requirements of a hazardous waste chemical landfill. It is that strict, and this is what's being used for what we call non-hazardous municipal solid waste. So it's a pretty strict design standard in terms of what's required in terms of groundwater protection. So that's pretty strict.
So what led me to you was I had the privilege of flying with some scientists from the Jet Propulsion Lab, NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, who are doing routine overflights of California with a special sensor that can pick up methane plumes. They discovered a particularly big plume at Sunshine Canyon in June, let that information be known to you and the landfill owners. And tell us what happened from then.
Well, this is a perfect illustration of the value of what we call real-time information, is that given the location of the plume and the date, we can tie it exactly to what was going on at the landfill. And it just happened that the identification of the area where there's a plume was where they were preparing for future disposal, and they were scraping away the very thick intermediate cover and the spray-on material that's used as intermediate cover. And by scraping this material to thin out the layer of dirt, what happened is that the landfill gas, the methane, was coming through the very thin layer and was accumulating around that centroid. And that was identified by JPL, NASA. And as landfill operations go, you try to prepare your disposal area well ahead of time. But by doing that, you actually created a larger time frame for methane to be emitted from the landfill. So what the landfill did on their own, and I have to give them kudos for this, is that they said, we can actually reduce the amount of methane being coming through the landfill and also reduce the potential for odors by not removing the intermediate cover so far ahead of time, but just by reducing the time so it's right before we're going to use that area for disposal. So by shortening the time of removal and the time of disposal, they're able to implement a best management practice that's not even required by the regulations, which significantly reduced the amount of methane being generated from the landfill.
It really underscores the point of what methane generators landfills can be, that that tiny little piece of the landfill could be exposed for that short period of time, and yet it would create a significant plume.
Yes. You know, as I've explained to you earlier, landfills have to operate under positive pressure. Landfills have this very extensive gas collection system that operate under a vacuum, but the vacuum can never be enough to capture 100% of the landfill gas, because you don't want to be cranking up that vacuum as to draw oxygen into the landfill, which causes underground fires, which is a lot worse, and you don't want that. So landfills in total is operated, like I said, on a positive. So they are emitting at all times to keep the from fires from developing underground.
That would be a stubborn fire that would be pretty hard to put out, I imagine, if you had an underground fire going. That's happened in the past, hasn't it?
Yes. And there's actually cases that's recorded where landfills have been on fires for over years of time.
At the edge of this particular facility is a power generation facility. Some of the methane is used to drive a turbine, not unlike a jet engine, and it is supplying enough energy to run 20,000 homes. That sounds like a great idea. Why not build more of those to capture more of the methane to turn it into electricity?
Actually, that facility is considering doubling the size of that plant. Certainly, the amount of landfill gas is there. But I think it took almost 7 years just to get the permits to construct. So that's a big part of the process, because in California, the regulatory review and the permitting process takes a very, very long time, and it's very extensive in terms of what has to be considered for the protection of the environment and for public safety.
But would you think it'd be a good idea? I mean, what percentage of the methane is now used to generate electricity there? And is there a reasonable amount of methane that could be captured and generate more electricity?
Yeah, just ballpark, I would say somewhere about a third to a half of the methane that is generated is actually used at the power plant. So they could probably double the size of that thing in the future. And utilize the methane to create electricity for the local homes.
One of the things we saw as we toured there were some devices that are radiation detectors. What kinds of radioactive material ends up in there, and how is that handled?
Basically, at the entrance to the landfill, what we call the scales that weigh the trucks, before you drive onto the trucks, there are a set of radiation detectors. And 95% of the time, when something goes off, it's related to medical treatment. And so these radiation monitors are so sensitive that a driver of a truck that basically had radiation treatment for cancer, even a week prior to coming to the landfill, when he drives in, that residual radiation will set off that alarm. So the landfill has to check, is it the driver or is it the trash? But if it's the trash, like I said, 95% of the time, it's probably traced back to some adult diaper that, from somebody that had radiation treatment for cancer. And the half-life of the radioactive isotope is so short that all they have to do is basically park their truck for a little while, not about a day, and then the radiation's gone. It's non-detect.
And then it's allowed to
yes.
be put in. So give us some of the things, the strangest, oddest, unusual things that you've seen in landfills over the years.
Well, locally in LA, I think the strangest thing was a load where the radiation monitor was set off. And it turned out it was the city staff actually sorted through the entire load of trash and found basically it was radioactive kitty litter. So what happened was somebody loved their cat so much, and it happened the cat had cancer. The cat actually went through radiation treatment. So the kitty litter with the radioactive cat piss basically ended up in the trash. And that set off the alarm. Yeah, that's here in California, but in other countries, basically. So one of the more strangest ones, which we weren't expecting, where we were sorting waste in Saudi Arabia. And all of a sudden, this giant bone showed up. We go, what is that? And it turned out it was a camel bone. We have forgotten that they eat camels over there. And of course, in the next load that we were sorting, and we were sorting because we wanted to understand the waste composition of Saudi Arabia for planning for waste management options, was the head of the camel. So we basically figured out it was the camel. You don't see that in the U.S.
Trash. Really, if you talk to an anthropologist, what they will tell you is, if you want to find out about a culture, find the trash pile, and yes, and you will know pretty much everything you need to know about how they lived, right?
Yes, that's actually true. I will tell you that trash from Hollywood is probably the strangest, because we regularly do waste composition studies to understand what's being disposed and how to plan to recycle. And actually, we found a foot in the trash stream, and we were so horrified. But it turned out it was from a prop shop. It was so realistic, we thought it was a real foot. We almost called the police on that one.
So you told me also that there are people who actually mine in landfills. Where does that happen and why?
I'm going to use the word mine loosely, because in other countries, especially in poor countries, there are people that live on landfills and basically make their living scavenging through trash on an active landfill to sell the recyclables. So we call that scavenging. That's not really allowed here in the U.S. But in some countries where land is so valuable, they will actually reclaim the land by mining the landfill, or what we call clean closure, by removing the entire landfill and trying to recover the useful materials like the metals and things out of it. And actually then take the what we call the stabilized humic materials, and that's actually going to be used as soil. And big part of that is to reclaim the land for better use than a landfill, but at the same time be able to reclaim valuable resources from the that were disposed, previously disposed.
So if trash is a window into our character or our souls, what does American trash tell you about us?
Very wasteful people. That's basically it. And and hosting engineers from other countries, some of our waste practices seem pretty barbaric in terms of, the practices that have been implemented in other countries. I've pretty much been consistently saying we're about 25, 30 years behind the state-of-the-art in some of the more developed countries. But the good part about that, from being behind, is we have lots of good examples to learn from. And if we've put our minds to it, and I think in this country, we can actually get caught up and actually be in the lead in about 10 years. But that takes leadership in this field.
There's that old Winston Churchill quote, "You can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they have exhausted every other option." So maybe that'll happen. But do you have some specific advice in closing here? If you were the king of the trash world in this country, what would you do?
I like to approach this things from a systems approach. That means look at all the aspects and how it could help. So one of the keys is education, revamp that, better science and math. And if you look at other countries, they start environmental education in the first grade or even younger. And trash management is actually an integral part of the curriculum. That is not in this country, so that's one thing. And then second part is, I think governance is so key. This is political leadership. And many of the countries, like Singapore that I visited, governance is so important. They're policy makers. They're pretty much all PhDs in engineering. So you have very capable technical people understanding policy and the technical limitations of what can be done. I think we need a lot more leadership positions that are headed by more technical people. We have a lot of very smart policy people, but I think they need to have really a reality check on technology, on the sciences side.
I don't want to minimize your contribution because you are a part of the regulatory process, but why don't you run for something?
I'm almost 70 years old, and I'm hiking the landfill pretty much every week and carrying 40 pounds of gear. So, and I was already thinking about retiring 20 years ago, except the people I work for won't let me retire, so...
Well, we're sitting in your mother's home in Northridge. She's 94, and she just got back from a Middle Eastern cruise and looks fantastic. I think you got good genes. I think you got quite a few good years left.
Yes, and I've actually been told that it doesn't matter how old I am. They will wheel me out in a wheelchair if that landfill is still operating.
So before we go, I'm sure there are a few people listening who think, well, you know, it's funny because when we talk about climate change, people get so frustrated because they feel the problem is so big and there's so little they can do as an individual. But let's give them some things. What are some concrete things individuals can do to do their part to help this particular problem?
Let me preface my answer, because there's a lot of people that think that the individual really can't make a difference. I do not believe that. I think individual contributions add up and they really make a very, very big difference. And it really goes to the long term of how we live our lives in terms of trying to understand what the impact of how we live. There's a saying, live simply so others may live. And so, and we're such a consumer-based society, but you can shop smart. We call that environmental preferred purchasing. You can make decisions to consume less, or in terms of waste generation, there's a lot you can do as a generator slash consumer. You can buy things that are of higher quality or more durable. The perfect example of is don't buy a cheap tire that only lasts 20,000 miles. Buy something that lasts 80,000 miles. So you don't have to replace that tire, the set of tires, four times. We call that waste reduction or source reduction. Get things of higher quality, last longer, so you don't have to get away from disposables. That's things like that. There's so many things individuals can do on a consumer level. And there are lots of resources that you can go to tell you how you can be a better consumer or as a better resident in a community. I think that's, and I think just learn about the impact of your actions. In other countries, people understand that when they generate trash, that impacts greenhouse gas. We don't have that education here. So my goal is just learn to be smart and just learn. And I think that's just part of life, just continually to learn.
We buy an awful lot of things that we don't use, that we just waste, whether it's clothing, whether it is the tire, or whether it is the food we eat. And everything we put in that bag does have an impact on climate change. So it's worth remembering as we march forward here, I think.
Correct.
All right. Yujing Sung, the world's most overeducated garbage man, a professor at UCLA in both engineering and the law. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And thank you for listening to this edition of Miles to Go. And when you're done with it, by all means, recycle.